Good evening, welcome to another edition of Little Atoms with me, Neil Denny. Each episode of Little Atoms features a guest from the worlds of science, journalism, politics, academia, human rights, or the arts in conversation. And tonight I'm very pleased to be welcoming back for the third time an old friend of the show, Jonathan Meads. Jonathan is a writer on architecture, culture and food, a novelist and television presenter. He was a restaurant critic at the Times for 15 years. Jonathan's writing includes the short story collection Filthy English, the novels Pompey and the Fowler Family Business, and a collection of food writing, Incest and Morris Dancing. The end of September saw the release by BBC DVD of the Jonathan Meads collection, a box set, which features 10 examples of Jonathan's singular televisual essays, and that's what we're going to be talking about tonight. So thanks very much for coming back, Jonathan.
Thank you for having me, as they say.
At one point, it was sort of mooted that the whole of your oeuvre might be coming out on a box set, and now it's what's actually come out is, I think, was just 13 episodes. And I just wonder if there's any particular reason for the films you've chosen to be on there.
Well, I think to have released all of my stuff, which was getting on for 50 films, would have been a huge commercial risk. So there's obviously a possibility that they will be released in the future if this one does okay, so everyone should go and buy one. The choice was determined by a number of factors. I made a wish list of the stuff that I thought ought to go out. I looked back over all the stuff I've done, and there were certain programs I didn't think were worth putting out, which I hadn't worked for one reason or another. Of the stuff which I was, that was probably, of 50 programs, probably about 8 I had worries about. Of the rest, I wanted to make it representative of the work that I've done over almost 20 years, and so didn't want to concentrate too much on one particular phase of it, and there are definitely phases throughout it. Once I'd established that list, one then ran into the problem of music clearances. Certain programs would have been punitively expensive to clear because there was a huge amount of music from very diverse sources. There are one or two programmes which would have actually cost nothing, which still didn't go on there. I mean, for instance, Jerry Building, about Nazi architecture and the folksiness of Nazism, did have specially composed music. But to have put that on there would then invite the idea of putting on Joe Building, which was about Stalin's architecture and its singular lack of folksiness. And it would have looked odd, I think, to have had one without the other. So eventually, like most things in life, it's a compromise, but it's a compromise I'm actually quite pleased with. I mean, there's nothing there I would not which I'm not sort of proud of in some way or other.
The first time you were on the show, we talked quite a bit about the influences of, you know, who had influenced you in your filmmaking, and one of the things you talked about was about comedy, and you mentioned particularly Marty Feldman back then. And it's when you actually watch a sequence of your film, so the opportunity is afforded to do that by this box set. When you watch them progressing over the career, you can see that a lot. It's really obvious. They're funny. Obvious how funny they are is what I'm trying to say. So perhaps I'd like to talk a little bit more about this, about you know, how comedy has influenced you.
Well, a lot of comedy leaves me absolutely cold. I often think there's nothing actually so unfunny as comedy. But then there are these wonderful exceptions, Marty Feldman being one. I also like a lot of Benny Hill stuff. I like Ernie. In fact, I choose Ernie for his Delta Sign disc, had Mr. Cameron not chosen it, and I don't want to really be seen following in his remarkable wake. I like slapstick. I like low comedy. But what I think Feldman did wonderfully was to combine a very, very sharp wit with knockabout, which is a very unusual combination. And it's something that I guess I've tried to emulate. But, I mean, the moments of sheer beauty in Feldman. I mean, for instance, when he's wearing a wig and a dress and complaining that he can't get a date, and it must be because of my English rose looks. I just fall about when, you know, stuff like that. I mean, more recently, I guess Chris Morris, although I can't think that Chris Morris could have my stuff has nothing to do with what he does, but I still think he's wonderfully funny. I don't go for his stuff when he's not funny.
So let's talk about then how that, you know, how you carried that across into the filmmaking.
Well, I think that one of the besetting problems of films about the environment, or indeed about the arts in general, but especially about architecture, is they mistake sort of po-faced earnestness for seriousness. And I think you can be funny and serious. I think it's a given. But there is a mentality which maintains that this isn't the case. And I had never been, I wasn't really terribly taken with much architecture and topography on television, with the exception of Betjeman, who was actually very droll. I mean, there's something of a kind of vaudevillian in him. And Ian Nairn, who wasn't particularly funny on telly. He was funny in his prose, but, I mean, he was so emotionally tied into places that one can forgive him for not being funny. But there had been a whole series of stuff of several years of things like Architecture at the Crossroads and so on, which is really like switching on the television and watching a coffee table book. I mean, it's really dire stuff and badly written. Whereas, I mean, I, having been a writer rather than someone from, you know, out of telly, I mean, a lot of telly stuff is written by people who aren't writers. I mean, they're, you know, it's written by a producer who happens to be the only person around. I determined to write scripts which were like, and they're written like drama scripts. I mean, every shot and so on. And if you're writing like that, you can be comedic in one way or another, or attempt to be comedic anyway.
There is quite an interesting tension there, because first of all, obviously, it's not usual for what would be called a serious documentary about a serious subject to have sort of humour in it as well. But also, it's often quite divisive in terms of, you know, I've often seen people complain about this. If you look at where people have been written to the BBC, they will say this programme was interesting, but, you know, the presenter puts himself forward into the, you know, it's about him rather than about the documentary. And this is interesting because you clearly play with this, and you do things like, there's in one of the documentaries that's on this box set, there's a really fantastic scene where there's a model village, and you walk across a model village and stamp on a couple of the people and then set fire to a Thatch cottage, and it's quite shocking, you know. It's like, and clearly that's, you're very deliberately taking the putting yourself in the frame thing to an extreme at that point.
What else do you do with model villages?
This is very true indeed.
Yeah, I would prefer my reaction to be to places and things to be my own reaction, rather than that of the kind of person who does late show items. I mean, you know, the kind of guff. And also, I think that one has to reach out for an audience which is not a specialist audience. And one can do that by talking down to people, and that is normally what is done, and treating everyone as if they're a sun reader and so on. Or you can do it by entertaining them in some way which was perhaps unprecedented. And you know, imagination costs nothing. And you think up gags, and it's all pretty low tech. There's
sight gags. There's obviously a lot of sight gags.
Yeah, lots of sight gags. But why be dull? Why be worthy? I don't see any excuse for it. I mean, it's rather like, you know, the Cecil Beaton thing about, you know, bad taste is fine, good taste is fine, no taste is really boring. Yeah. And I just think you don't want to be boring. I mean, you want to, you know, you want to do something that you want to see yourself. And that, I think, is something which critics very, very seldom take into account when they're looking at any form of creative endeavour. The idea that the person who writes the book or paints the painting is actually the first audience of the work. And to an extent, you write because you want to read it. And I make television shows. I don't think they're documentaries, incidentally. I mean, they don't really have any element of documentary in them. But I make shows that I want to see. And the ones which didn't get anywhere near getting on this thing's the ones I don't want to see again.
How would you categorise them? I called them televisual essays, which seems a bit of a contrived thing, but how would you...
Shows. It's lecture theatre and vaudeville theatre at the same time, I hope.
Let's have a look at some of the shows a bit more closely then, some of the ones that are on this box set, and or at least some of the ideas. Let's talk around some of the ideas that are raised in the shows. I want to start with Remember the Future, which I'm happy to out myself, but this is my favourite of all of your shows. You talk about the idea of a point where people's faith in the future and a faith in science and progress and the white heat of technology, about how that's sort of gone now. This is like a thing of a certain period of time, the Festival of Britain era, I suppose.
Well, the Cold War, obviously, as well.
Yeah, I mean, we'll sort of come to that in a minute, because the Cold War features quite heavily, and the buildings that you look at, obviously, a lot of them are there for that particular reason. But why do you think the idea of progress went? Why do you think people are so suspicious of it now?
Well, I think you get to a point where perhaps there is a delusion that one is progressing towards a point, and that point has been reached. So somewhere in the in the 70s, one began to get a kind of institutionalised retrospection. People looking back to, you could see this in clothes of sort of late hippiedom and so on, in the way that modernism lost all confidence in itself, the way that the public lost confidence in modern architecture and so on. And the fact that we'd got to the moon and there wasn't much, that was a great achievement. And it seemed to be kind of finite.
Well, you mentioned in the show the idea of the planets as being the next place for us to colonise, sort of thing. There was this idea that the moon was the first step.
Oh yeah, that we were all going to go on holiday. Space travel would become a norm. It didn't. And that, I suppose, the fact that it didn't is another cause of the mistrust of progress, because there has been a huge amount of progress. I mean, a mobile phone is like that. The first mobile phones were like breeze blocks and about as heavy. Technology may have impinged on our lives in the way that we lead our lives. Obviously, the net has in a huge way, and everyone has a computer. But it has not been so visually aggressive as it was during that point, because what that laptop can do in a few centimetres square used to take something the size of this room. And so technology was very, very big, very apparent. It altered the landscape and so on. Now we can have the benefits, if that's the right word, and I do believe it is, of technology without particularly altering the environment in the same way. And so there is a mistrust of the equation between technological and social progress, but there's no lack of fondness for gadgets and what they'll do for us. And there's, I suppose, a generational thing too, because if you grow up with all these things around you and take them for granted, there is not the excitement that mm-hmm. there was in the years between the end of the Second World War and the first oil crisis. I mean, what the French called les temps glorieux, that's when in France you got the DS and you got high speed trains. You got Formica, which was very, very exciting. All of that was It's also you can't ever rule out fashion, because people talk of the 60s as if it's in some way kind of homogenous. But you look at Courrèges clothes, and then only about a year later, the caftans and all of that stuff. You're into a completely different world, and you know, girls wearing long sort of pre-Raphaelite dresses and so on. Fashion does play a part in all of this, and the fashion for the space age and for technology, which even cosmetically reflected the space age, dissipated. You know, sometime round about Sergeant Pepper's.
It could be said that in that sort of image of science, of progress, and again, you know, the white heat of technology, there was, if we can call it this, a vision of how, you know, the future was going to be and how society perhaps should be ordered, and just as you said, everybody getting behind the idea of the space race and things. There was something of a vision there, and I think it's interesting to compare this program to one of your much later programs, On the Brandwagon, which is basically about another vision for the future and how we sort of should be ordered, but it's just unbelievably banal in comparison. You know, the idea of the future being sort of dictated by spin doctors and things in the way it has become. I mean, how do we get there?
Well, I mean, I think the stuff, what I was trying to show in On the Brandwagon, was that regeneration is a kind of self-referential racket, and that the people who benefit from regeneration are people in the building industry, whether it be architects, quantity surveyors, the huge construction companies, or people actually on the ground putting the things together. And that building, I mean, you've got various things. You've got kind of almost like social cleansing in big British cities, where people on low incomes are basically pushed out to the peripheries in the way that they are in French or Spanish cities. And you have to question the kind of the motives, again, because who benefits from it apart from the construction industry, as I say, the building endless sort of synthetic modern or FOMO flats for people in financial services. Obviously, I mean, you've got a balcony, you can throw yourself off now. But it's not really going to, it's not a catalyst of social improvement. The 60s may have got things wrong, but at least they believed, there was this idea of architectural determinism, that by giving people better places to live, their lives might be improved and their chances ameliorated. No one thinks such a thing now, partly because of a few housing failures in the 60s. I mean, I think the housing failures of the 60s have been vastly over-exaggerated. And, you know, you get people of the quality of Margaret Hodge saying that Robin Hood Gardens has to be pulled down, and I don't want to hear any more about daring avant-garde architecture. It wasn't actually particularly avant-garde, and there was nothing wrong with it. I mean, the apartment blocks like that work for the rich, and they work for the less rich in virtually every other country in the world, because they're maintained. I mean, you don't buy a car and never take it to the garage to have it serviced. And there was a presumption on the part of local councils in Britain that you built a tower block and then just left it to rot. You know, no janitors, nothing. Anyone could walk in to pee in the lift, and anyone did. But the regeneration which one is seeing now of I'm quite how the thinking goes. One can see how the thinking goes, and it's very banal. I mean, everyone tries to do what Bilbao has done. But what do museums do, especially when there's nothing to put in the museums? They don't do anything. They're just structures, kind of architecture as sculpture, shoved down usually in some bit of former dockland. It's crazy. It's a kind of vanity, and it's this kind of corporate or municipal vanity that, you know, if Manchester has got the Lowry and the Imperial War Museum of the North, which have resulted in a complete, you know, it's wiped out gun crime in Hume and no one's been stabbed and there are no cracked ends left on Moss Side. If you can do that in Manchester, why not have the Royal Armouries in Leeds, which is going to have the same beneficial effects? And so no one from Leeds United fan will ever taunt a black player as a monkey thereafter. I mean, we can see this. It's a huge improvement with being in our cities.
Well, I want to go back to something you mentioned before, which was girls in pre-Raphaelite dresses and caftans for the next programme. Of all of the ones you've chosen for this box set, there's one that particularly stands out to me, and that's in Search of Bohemia. And it's the only one that seems to me... There's a fantastic phrase which you use to present the next series on from this one, Abroad Again, which is where you call it a distant present, you talk about, which I think is a really interesting phrase. In Search of Bohemia really seems to sort of represent that to me. It's like it's the one that's... and. I don't want to say dated, because that's not the word I mean, but it's the one that looks most of a particular time. And it seems to me now that in the weird way that sort of time sort of telescopes, although this was made in 1990, and you're talking about the period of sort of Augustus John and that, it almost seems like we're as far from the people that you feature in that programme now as they were from that period that you're sort of talking about. It seems like it's a world that's completely and utterly vanished. Now, I mean, in that was the conceit of the programme, that you're searching for something that doesn't really exist anymore. Now it seems... And I was sort of playing a sort of thought experiment with this one myself and thinking, if you were going to remake this programme or do a sort of follow-up to it, you just couldn't, could you? Where would you find that now? You know, where would you find that sort of avant-garde in that sort of bohemian way that's like totally unfettered by any sort of money or corporate sort of thing?
I think that sort of bohemianism does exist still. I really do. It's something, though. I mean, most of that, the genesis of that program was that I wanted to make a show about Hastings. Where at that point a lot of painters had left London in, I guess, the mid-70s and gone down to Hastings, partly because you get huge properties with rooms which were ideal as studios and so on. And it was almost like a kind of unacknowledged St. Ives, in the way that, you know, what St. Ives had been at the time of Peter Lanyon, Hepworth, etc., in the 1950s. And I knew some of these Hastings painters. I went and talked to them, and I didn't feel there was an... I thought it would make something rather like a kind of look-at-life film. I just wasn't happy with it. But I knew there was an area of Hastings called Bohemia, and I knew that quite near Salisbury and Fordingbridge, where Augustus John lived, there was a place called Bohemia. So, you know, the thing kind of coalesced as a result of that. I think you will still find in various spots of Britain people leading that sort of life. You'll never find it in London. I mean, it's completely non-metropolitan now. But in Stroud in Gloucestershire, in Totnes, in Devon, in various bits of Wales, there are people leading that sort of life, I promise you.
But do you not think that very lifestyle itself has become, you know, the sort of a lot of the countercultural stuff becomes just another product to be sold back to?
Oh, yes, absolutely, it is. But nonetheless, it still exists. I mean, it may exist without the kind of particular rationale that prompted its fomentation in the first place. But I think it does exist. Although, of course, I mean, you know, it goes without saying there's an awful, you know, Muriel Spark said in the 1940s in Girls of Slender Means, all which she wrote in 1963, I think, in 1946, all the nice people were poor, which is a very quaint sounding sentiment today. Wasn't so quaint then. But I think, looking back at any past, you're obviously looking at the present. I mean, one cannot help but do so. And so it is dated in a way, and it is rather kind of cutesier than most of my stuff.
The next one, then, that I want to talk about is Get High, which we really see you suffering for your art in this one, because it's about... Well, you introduced the idea of buildings as being intoxicating, as the idea of psychotropic structures, in that you look at tall buildings and buildings that will induce vertigo, and you look at the idea of vertigo as a form of sort of intoxication, and I presume you do suffer from vertigo.
Yeah, I suffer very, very badly from vertigo, and have suffered from it since I was 20, when I got stranded on the top of a very high bridge in France, Pont d'Aquitaine, just outside Bordeaux. A friend of mine's car broke down, and I sort of, we were waiting for the passing car to stop, and I just looked over the side of the bridge, and that was it. I mean, I'd never suffered vertigo before then, but I very crassly thought that doing this might cure me of it. In actual fact, it exacerbated it terribly. But I was interested in the way in which it's almost seems to be built into a lot of structures. I mean, a tall structure doesn't necessarily need to be particularly vertiginous. There are all sorts of ways in which you can stop people suffering that sensation. But if you have sheer glass walls, when you're kind of 200 metres up in the sky, and the walls come right down to the floor, it is to me rarely horrible. But it's quite clear that an awful lot of architects simply don't realise the effects that they are achieving, or pretend not to realise.
Well, that's interesting, because then there's something like the new spire tall thing in Portsmouth, on Portsmouth Harbour.
Well, Spinnaker.
Mm. Yeah. It's got like a glass floor at the top as well, which is like some sort of, you know, it's almost like a, you know, for thrill seekers to go and stand on this extremely thick glass looking down at the
thing. That's the thing, cantilevered out over the Grand Canyon. Very, very similar. The Spinnaker, I mean, I wouldn't risk it, because the architect got stuck in it on the day that it opened in one of the lifts, which is
it's a
risky proposition.
Well, we're about out of time, so it's gone extremely quickly. So thanks very much for coming and speaking to us again, Jonathan.
Thank you.
And again, the box set is called the Jonathan Meads Collection, and it's available on Amazon for, I think, about £26, which is a bargain, and it's by BBC DVD. Thanks for listening. Thank you.